this is Janet Levine for the National Park Service, and I'm here today. I'm here today in Margate, Florida, at the home of Shirley Rothman. I'm here with Lillian Lieberman Levine and Shirley Lieberman Rothman, who are sisters, who came from Poland in 1921 when Lillian was 11 and Shirley was 13 years old. Today is April 26th, 1993, and this is a return engagement since the tape recorder was not functioning completely well on our first interview, which was on May 10th, 1992. Well, I'm very happy to have the chance to talk with you both again, and we'll try to fill in some of the gaps from the last tape, and then we'll see if there's something new that we didn't even mention last time. And I want to mention that Nathan Levine, Lillian Levine's husband, is also here with us today in Margate. Okay. Maybe just for the beginning of this tape, too, if you would say your birth dates and where in Poland you were born.
Well, I'm not so happy to repeat the birth date, but you know, as it says in the first tape, that was sometime in February 1910, I believe. And I was born in Ostrów Mazowieck, Poland. And Shirley.
And I'm Shirley. I was 13 when we arrived in this country in January of 1921. And I, too, was born in Ostrów Mazowieck, Łomża Gubernia. I'll add that because it's part of our address. And we are here today to answer any questions or relate any stories of our life.
Okay, why don't we start with stories about your grandfather, because I know he was very important to you. And I think that in the first tape, there was a gap in some of the stories. So if you can just think of any experiences with your grandfather prior to you leaving.
Well, I can recall that he was a great help to my mother, packing things together, and he was running back and forth from his house to our apartment, and also that when we didn't feel well, we used to come to him, and he had methods of curing a sore throat, toothaches, which I don't recall the toothaches actually, but if anybody needed that, I suppose he was able to help that too. This is my recollection, and there are other recollections, but I don't know exactly where to begin. So Shirley may have something to add.
Well, I know that we loved our grandfather a great deal. He was part of our life, and like Lillian said, he had methods of helping any illness that we had as children without a medical degree. He knew exactly what to do. If I had a sore throat, he would come in with a teaspoon and squeeze out the pus from my tonsil, and I would get better the very next day. But the most important part, I don't know whether you want me to repeat that story when we left Ostrava, or should we leave that for later?
When you left?
Yes.
The story when you left?
Yeah.
Well, it's a poignant story.
Yeah. Is there something you want to talk about before we do this?
No, it's already on the tape. I don't know if you want to repeat that. It's
Well, Janet says she wants to make a new tape.
Why? I think.
Tell about his business upstairs that he had. That
maybe employed. First also his name.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Tell about his business upstairs that employed your uncle and everybody there.
My grandfather's name was Shlomo Kwiatek.
Can you spell it?
Yeah, I will spell the name Kwiatek. K-W-I-A-T-E-K. We have one relative in this country who still maintains that name. His sons, who were my uncles, all changed their name when they came to America. They all changed their name to Bloom, which means Kwiatek. Kwiatek means flower, and so they changed it to Bloom. They wanted to be Americanized, and they used that name. I prefer the name Kwiatek because it's unusual and different, but my uncles didn't feel that way. Is there anything else you want to add, Lil?
I don't know what Janet wants. I really don't have any idea what you want us to say, except our grandfather was the father figure. He was instead of a father, and because our father was in America, and when he wasn't in America, he was very little at home. So he represented the father figure, and we loved him dearly, and he was very devoted to us. So that's one thing. I don't know, you wanted Shirley to repeat the story about when we left in that cold night for America. If you want that repeated, I think Shirley tells it best, so I'll let her do that.
This is one memory in my life that I will never forget, and it's the saddest memory because we all loved my grandfather, like we have already said, and we had to leave to come to this country. We had to leave and make a train going to Warsaw, and we had to leave at about in the middle of the night, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and it was in the mid December, and it was very, very cold. It was bitter cold, but it was a beautiful night where the moon was shining and the snow and the ice were glistening. And my grandfather got up and he helped us get onto the carriage. It was an open platform like a truck, which was drawn by horses, to help us carry our belongings onto that and to say goodbye to us for the last time because he knew he would never see us again. And he helped us on, and the carriage or the truck started moving away, and he was running after it and crying, and it was so sad. And we all cried, and I will never, never forget this.
Very warm here.
You want me to put on the fan?
Maybe just in summarizing, before we leave your life in Poland, how would you describe your life in Poland prior to leaving for the United States? Just kind of
some memories come back very fast, and one of these memories, I believe, we did not say anything about on the first tape, and that was the time when war broke out in Europe, and the battles were coming closer and closer to where we lived. We all had to get into a cellar in order to have some security from the bombs or from the bullets or from the guns. And that's where we stayed all night. And when we finally did get out, it was very early in the morning, and lots of people piled into our small two-room apartment. And we all stretched out on wherever we could find a space. I guess the children were put into bed, and the others stayed wherever they could in that two-room apartment. This is very vivid. I can recall that, but even more vivid is the time when the war was already in progress for quite a number of years, and there was an air raid in the town. We had an air raid, and we again had to get into the cellar. We got into the cellar, but this time we did not close doors because we knew that the raid would have short duration. We left the doors open, whereas in the first time when we got into the cellars, all the doors were locked very tight, two sets of doors, one up on top, one on the bottom. But this particular one, the one that I wanted to tell about, is when we did not lock the doors, and when the air raid sirens went off, there were two people that ran into our cellar, two Polish people, a man and a woman. shortly thereafter, some Polish soldiers came to that cellar, and they saw us all assembled there. And they were very suspicious, and they accused us of being spies, and they pointed their guns at us. They were going to kill everybody in there. But luckily, we had those two Polish people there. The man was an anti-Semite, and he said, shoot them all. They're no good.
Jews.
They're all Jews, and shoot them all. The woman, on the other hand, was very sympathetic, and she got on her knees, and she pleaded with them, and she said, these are innocent people. We ran in from the street. She thought that we had run in from the street, which we had not, but that's what she thought. And leave them alone and leave us alone. We are innocent people. She pleaded so long until they finally they left us alone and they went away. But our lives were very much in danger at that time. The guns were pointed right at us. This I'll never forget. This is one memory that I'll never forget. In fact, I told this very story to my third grade class when I was here such a short time, but my teacher asked questions, and I answered that question by telling that story. And I think the little girls and the little boys in that class were very much concerned and very interested in that story. So that's my story. Now, is there anything else, Janet, that you would like to know? Shirley may have something to say about this.
Well, I guess we'll be talking about leaving Poland. So if there's anything...
Shirley, do you want to add anything to that story?
Yes, I remember it very clearly, too. And I remember being so frightened and so scared that I wanted to, like, creep into the wall. And when we finally, when this woman, she crossed herself and begged these men, she said, these are innocent people who ran away from the bullets. There was an air raid or something. And we heard the bullets being shot at us. And so when we finally got out of that cellar and went into the house, I remember I threw up everything I ever ate in my life, because from fright, I was so scared that I didn't know what, and I was like sick for the rest of the day. Those are the things that we went through many times. We lived in that cellar a lot during the war, because there were attacks, all kinds of attacks. Until the Germans took over, we had all kinds of battles going on in that little town where we lived. So we lived through this a lot. We were in the cellar a lot, trying to hide. That was the only place where we felt safe, that the bullets wouldn't reach us. And this is what we had to go through during our young days.
Were there other incidents of anti-Semitism?
There were quite a few. Yes, there were.
Experience?
Yes. I remember one time we went berry picking in the woods, my mother and all of us children, I think. I remember you and I, Lil, were there, and we took along bread and something to drink, and so we spent most of the day picking berries, and I remember we filled up a whole bucket full of berries, and we were on our way home going on the road, and some Polish boys saw us, and they attacked us, and they spilled our berries all over the road. The Polish people, unfortunately, I have to say, were very anti-Semitic. They didn't like the Jews, which is too bad, because we were very peace-loving and just trying to get along. We didn't want much from them. But these are the kind of things that last in your mind, you know, you can remember.
Mm-hmm. What was the composition of the town? Was it about half and half as far as Jewish and Gentile, or was it more of a difference in the balance?
Go ahead. Well, I would say that the town, the main streets of the town were more or less Jewish, more Jewish. The Polish people were mostly farmers.
And they were around
the town. But the Jewish people lived within the town. They had small businesses, a grocery store, or a a bakery or a ready-to-wear store or kind of thing, a shoe store, like Ben was in the shoe store. And but the Jewish people lived in the town, the Polish outside of the town.
Can you describe the house where you lived?
Yes, of course. It was, actually, there were more than one apartments. I think they had about three or four apartments in that particular area of the building. Ours, you had to walk up about four steps. It was just a two-room apartment. The living room, the dining room, the bedroom was all in one room. And then there was a kitchen, which was large living room, dining room, bedroom. The kitchen was sort of a narrow, long, the same length, the whole length of the apartment. And we had, I think it was coal that we used to use, or wood, for heating. And the oven part that you open up to put the wood in was in the kitchen. And on the other side of the wall was the place where you got a lot of heat. There were tiles, white or some colored tiles. I think they were white mostly. And that wall became very warm. And that's, we used to stand up against that to get some warmth. And we had all the furniture we needed, I suppose, two big beds where we shared. That's all. My mother and two children slept in one, and we slept in the other, Shirley and I, and occasionally there were other people sleeping with us, my mother's brother, my mother's brother-in-law, which was, I think, the wrong thing to do, but that we didn't know about those things, and certainly not I, and I hope my mother didn't either, because she shouldn't have allowed that, I feel. But anyhow, that's the way it was, and the four chairs were around the table. And if we should see someone coming to visit, we were four girls, and we didn't want anybody to sit on those chairs. So if we saw someone come in toward the, from the street, we would run into the house, and we would sit on the chairs. We vied with one another. We did not want anyone to take our chair. So we came and we sat, the people who came to visit. I don't know what they did, because we wouldn't give up the chairs.
Wait, we'll pause here. Okay, we're resuming now after a phone call. Okay, so you were sitting in the chair so that the visitors couldn't.
Yeah, that's right. And until my mother, of course, would tell us to kindly get up and give a seat to the... but we had our chairs... You could have printed our name on it because we were always in the same chair. But I wanted to add, as she, Lillian explained about the heating system that we had. The stove was in the open part of the oven, was in the kitchen where it was fed with wood and heated the whole apartment. On the other side, in the other room, was the tile wall, which got hot from the... But we also had like a Pripyatchuk. You may have heard that word. It was part of the oven that's flat of the wall. And we used to be able to sit on that and warm up. Yeah.
Well, that was the stove like a range?
That was different, no. We had a kitchen range, which also was fed by wood. But this was a heating system, which had like a little... door on top where you could put food into warm a part, you know, like a little closet up on top, a cabinet where you can put in things to warm. And the whole wall on the other side got all heated up so that it heated the second room. And this was our heating system. For cooking, we had another kind, also fed by wood. We had no electricity or anything like that.
What did you use for lighting?
We had kerosene lamps, one kerosene lamp in the whole big room.
And during the war, candles.
Yeah, that's right. And we had to do our homework by that light. When we went to school, I went to school, and Lillian went for a while also.
About the lighting system that we had, as Shirley said, the kerosene was, of course, probably the most effective. But during the war, must have had a shortage of kerosene, and we had to use candles, and candles were scarce too. And there was one family who lived upstairs. Their name was Abramchik, and Hanna was my friend. They had no candles, and they had no kerosene, and they had no lamps, and they had no food either, for that matter. And I recall we felt so sorry for them. We were poor ourselves, but they were even worse off. So we used to take the tallow that would melt from the candles. I remember that very distinctly. And we would put a thread into the soft tallow and roll it to make a candle out of it and bring it up to them. That's exactly how I remember it.
Yeah,
and it was,
I remember that too. From the overflow of the tallow, we'd use it again. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about your cousins? They lived nearby?
Yeah, they lived right across. We had, as I think I explained in the first tape, that we were right off a very large square, so, and the buildings were all around in a square. We lived at the, let's say, the south side, and they lived on the east side of that square. I used to go there for the lessons that Rose used to give me. I went there quite often because it was a daily thing, I guess, in those, at the, when I couldn't go to school. So I went there often, and I knew that apartment very well. But they came to us. Mostly they came to us. Ours was the meeting ground. And everyone was always welcome at our house. I guess it was my mother's attitude toward children and towards her family. And they used to come to us. I remember that... Also, again, during the war, those were the most vivid memories. Rose and Sylvia used to come Friday night, and after the candles went out, we used to sing mostly sad songs. Those were my recollections. Rose had a beautiful voice, and Sylvia had a beautiful voice, but Rose was even more beautiful. And we sang Polish songs from the war. And they knew so much Polish, and we were able to join in, and we sang Yiddish songs, and the atmosphere in the dark, it was very plaintive. I remember it was so sad. And we got to know them so much better. They came so often. We were always very close. And I think Shirley may be able to add a few things herself.
I just want to say that, you know, this family, our cousins and my aunt Esther and her family, who had six children, her husband also was in America. He left Europe, our country, Europe, to come to America when the war broke out because none of the boys wanted to be in the army. So they all left, my father and my uncle, and they all went to the... But I want to tell you... the way we lived, to give you an idea of the way we lived, my aunt, who had six children, lived in one room. I don't know how they slept. I can't imagine how they slept. She and six children were living in one room. Also, Lillian told you that they used to come to us all the time because, I don't know, well, they had one room, we had two rooms. And my mother, of course, always invited people to come. They used to come on Friday night and Saturday, all day Saturday, we'd sit and sing songs. And in fact, Sylvia, who was the younger of the girls, she was the second girl, second youngest in the family. She slept in our house a lot. She slept with us. She slept with Lillian and me. We were two in the bed. She was the third. There was always a third in the bed. And she got very ill at one time. I think we spoke about it during our first recording, that she got typhus, and she got very ill. She had a very high temperature, and her mother or the whole family did not want to put her in the hospital because they did not trust the hospitals or any of the care that was given to the six people in the hospital during the war. They really didn't care much about civilians. So we had to hide the fact that she was ill, and they had to get her out of our house so that we shouldn't be infected with that disease. So they carried her at night. They took her out of the house. They carried her in a blanket across the square to her aunt's house, who had an apartment somewhere also off the square. And on the way, they dropped her into the snow. But anyway, she was carried to that house. They put her in a room by herself, which must have been 0 degrees, but I think that's what helped her sickness. That cold room, and she was wrapped up in blankets, and she, of course, survived and got better, and she was okay. But at least we had to get her out of our house so that our 4 children should not be infected. I later on got it anyway, but I don't know whether it was through her or some other source. But anyway, we were all, what I want to stress very much is the closeness that we were with that family. We didn't consider them like cousins. They were almost like sisters. They were part of us. Whatever we did, we always did together. They're sisters and brothers. They were 6, and we were 4.
What were their names?
Rose was the oldest. Then came Sylvia. Then came David. Then Madeline. And Saul. Saul was the youngest. There's a little...
There were only 5, by the way, not 6. The 6th one must have died quite some time earlier before I can remember. That.
Okay, we're resuming now again.
Was there something
that you wanted to add about your cousins? You had mentioned about them earlier.
Well, I don't want to miss David, because David was very, very close, devoted friend and cousin. We were very close to him and loved him. He loved us. Shirley was his friend, and they used to socialize.
Because I was closest in age to him, that's why.
Yes. And I, of course, he was not in his company because I was maybe a couple of years younger. But he shared with us all his knowledge. As soon as he used to go to Cheder, and as soon as he learned something in Cheder, he would come over and teach us. He taught me the alphabet in Yiddish, how to write it and how to read it. And to this day, I can still read and write Jewish, all thanks to David, whom I miss very much, I must say, because I really was very fond of David. And Madeline was my very close friend. She took me into the Madison House. That was a settlement house, which was at 214 Madison. She lived at 216, and we lived at 214. We lived at 212, and the Madison House was at 216.
Madison Street.
Yes, that was Madison Street. Madison
this
House.
This is New York. Now.
This is This is the Lower East Side, and when we moved finally to the Lower East Side from the Bronx, it must have been, Madeline became my very dear friend. She introduced me to all her friends. By then, she had made some, and there was a club, and she took me into the club as a member, and we had about 15 or 20 girls in that very club, and we were always very, very friendly. We had lots of fun, but Madeline was my dearest friend. Now, of course, she lives in Miami Beach, and she has other interests and other friends, and we do see each other occasionally and speak to each other more often, but I still recall our dearest friendship, and that was with Madeline.
And you were your friendship with Madeline was also in Poland.
No, Madeline was not friendly in Poland with us at all. The only ones that we saw in that family were Rose, whom we loved, Sylvia, whom we loved, and David, whom we loved. They were our dearest friends, dearest cousins. They came to America with us. So that we were never without them. We were always together. But now we're without them, unfortunately. But that's not anything that we could have done anything about.
David didn't have a very long formal education, but he was very well educated in Hebrew. And he became... a director of a Hebrew school in Teaneck, New Jersey. I think it's comparable to the principal, wouldn't you say that, Lil?
Yes.
Yeah. And he became very active with helping Israel. And he went to Israel many, many times. And he finally died in Israel. And I think that was that was the place where he should have ended his life, because Israel was his love. He did a great deal of work for Israel, helped them. He went at least a dozen times. He'd speak to me or be in my house on Thursday, Saturday he was in Israel. He couldn't tell me that he was going, or he couldn't tell anybody. It was a secret, because he did certain things for Israel that could not be spoken about.
He died in Israel.
He died in Israel. And at that time, one of our other cousins was connected with CBS. He was a reporter.
I guess so.
He reported the news from Israel. His name was Danny Bloom. He was my Uncle Joe's son, younger son. And he was there at the time when David came to Israel. He always contacted him because he worked for CBS and he had a lot of things, you know, that he can do. So Danny, of course, when David died, Danny called the family from Israel to tell them what happened. And, of course, it was a very sad time for all of us. I, unfortunately, was in Florida at the time, right after a very serious illness, and I could not come. They would not allow me to go to New York for the funeral, and that I regret a great deal.
I was there at the funeral, and some very nice things were said about David. He was a very unusual person. He had so much knowledge. Never mind the education formally. He had so much knowledge. He was so well informed that education couldn't have done much more for him if he had a degree in whatever.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you could say something about the attitude of your family and also your cousins about education and about learning.
Well, it was important, but unfortunately, other things were even more important. Supporting the family was very important, so that I personally did not get enough time for education. I had to go to work as soon as possible when I was 16 years old. I did get some training, of course, in a business school for which my mother paid, and I got some jobs doing office work, and also became very proficient at that, and made nice salaries. But education was never out of the picture. It was always very important, especially to me. It was always very important.
Well, the reason that we couldn't afford to go to school is because my father abandoned us, so we had no one to support us. So that as soon as we reached the age of 16, and when we came to this country, someone had to guarantee that we would not become a public charge, that would not go on welfare, which is now known as welfare, so that someone had to guarantee this. And one of my uncles finally got his boss to sign for us that we would not be a public charge. So as soon as we became old enough, we had to go to work to support the rest of the family. And that's why we couldn't get any education. When I was 16, I left there. I had to go to school until I was 16. So, and then I went on to night high school. I used to go to school at night and work during the day so that I can bring in some money for the family to live on. My mother tried very hard, but she had four young children to take care of, and she couldn't leave us all alone. So she did work at home. I remember we used to help her. She used to go and get work. At that time, they had people taking homework. We did all kinds of things at home to make some money. But as soon as we were 16, we had to go to work, and we could not continue with any education. Of course, we always tried. We read and we tried to learn, but we don't have formal degrees.
What was your mother's name and maiden name?
My mother's name was Malke Kwiatkowiak. That was her maiden name. She married a man named Saul Mendel Lieberman, which was arranged. The marriage, of course, was arranged. She was introduced. She never went out with him on dates like as we are accustomed to. She met him maybe once, looked at him, and then after a certain proper time, there was a an engagement, which is in Hebrew, noyim, and after that, they got married and they lived together. My father was a he was a carpenter, or I would say he was more like a
master.
He was master master carpenter, like a cabinet maker. And but we lived in such a small town, he could not find work, so he always had to go away to find a job. And so we really didn't have much of a father. But my mother filled both parts very beautifully. She was wonderful. We never had any problems.
Is there anything else that you would say about life in Poland before we talk about leaving there?
Well, mostly I can recall during the war, because prior to that I was probably too young to remember very much. I do remember, however, when my father did leave for the United States, I was not very old, I must say, but I must have been 3 years old. But I recall grabbing at his leg for him not to go. I don't know whether he was going to America or not. He may have been going on a job, but I recall grabbing at his leg and trying to hold him down. He shouldn't leave. I guess we had an affection for him. Don't have that recollection as I grew older, but that's the only one that I do remember. And during the war, there were so many trials and tribulations. My mother had to do a lot of smuggling to make ends meet. One day she told me, while the Germans occupied our town, the Germans occupied our town for quite a while, I believe. They stayed until the Russian Revolution, probably, or probably till 1918 when they signed the treaty in November 11th, 1918. But I do recall this incident. My mother was smuggling some flour or sugar or whatever it was, and she told me to watch out for the German policeman. He was the chief of police, and he used to wear a cape. And they used to call him, everybody had some kind of a name other than his given name. They called him the Polerine. In Jewish, that means the cape. My mother said to me, you stand on this place. There was a sort of a little bit of water that used to run through the town. I don't know what it was. They called it a rough. A rough is, I don't know what.
A canal.
It was a very, very narrow canal.
Yeah.
I remember that very well. And there was a wooden bridge that was level with the ground, because the canal was depressed and the wooden bridge was on top. And my mother said, you stand on that bridge, and if you see him, let me know. Come to me. Tell me that he's coming and I should go in another direction. I was standing there. And I did finally see my mother coming from the left and the Polerine coming from the same direction. I said, what am I going to do? So quickly I decided, if I move, I'll attract attention. I stayed there, glued. And my mother saw that what was happening, and she realized that he was right behind her, and she quickly ran into some kind of a store or another one of the teos, that's what I recall them, and that's how she was saved from punishment. But this incident also stands out very clearly in my mind. I think I've mentioned it a few times to my husband. He said no, but I think I thought I did.
What was the word you used? Teos?
The teo. Yeah.
What is that?
What do you call that? A teo?
It's like the entrance to a fort, those big wooden doors.
Oh. Yeah, well, each court had this type of entrance. We called it the teia. I don't know what you call it here. It's just the entrance to
to the place where you live.
But it's large.
Oh, very large.
Well, to us it was large. It may not have been as large as we thought. But we were small, so to us it was enormous.
In that very same theater, we used to do all sorts of things. We used to play there. One time we made stilts for ourselves, and we walked on stilts.
Right.
I remember that was one of the things, how we played. At one time you asked us how we played.
Yes.
And we did that. We made the stilts, and we walked on stilts to see how well we can walk on stilts. And that's how we enjoyed our...
We had no toys ever to play with. So whatever we had to make it ourselves, like I told you once before. I never had a doll, or neither one of us, none of us ever had a doll. So we had to make one. I think in a way it was good, because we used our imagination, we used our skills, like she said, to make the stilts. We had seen them somewhere, maybe, I don't know how we knew about it, and so we repeated, we copied, and we used our imagination. We took pieces of wood and made stilts, and we walked on stilts.
And then we kept our balance. It took a little while, I guess, to really keep it well for a longer period of time. But it did develop that we were doing that quite well.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you could describe the courtyard with the families around it.
Oh, yes.
What that was like.
I'll tell you. I think Oz was the only one with a taya.
What is that?
The entrance. Because we lived in what was the city hall. The same place with the city hall. There was a big brick building. It was the city hall, and it had an entrance, like I would say, like the entrance to a palace. Big wooden doors, and you came into like to a grand entrance, an enormous foyer with these great big wooden doors that opened up. And the floor of that foyer was all wood, and there was the entrance to the city hall, and then on the left side was the entrance to a store, a fabric store.
Outside?
No, on the inside also. They had an entrance on the inside. And then you came through these doors and through that foyer, and there was a big courtyard, and it was surrounded by buildings. There was... one big brick building, in which the rich person of the town who owned the store on the main street lived, and the young girl was my friend. Her name was Hadassah. Then there was another tenant, and then there was a bakery in the basement, and then there was a wooden buildings. And which my grandfather and grandmother lived. And my grandfather had a little factory upstairs, a tanning factory. Then there were the outhouses and stalls for the animals. And then around the other side, there was another building in which we lived, and two tenants upstairs. And then there was an entrance to that woman with the cards. What was her name? Who played cards? She had the store, and she lived in the in back of the store. And this was the courtyard, and it was all, cobblestones.
Yes, cobblestones.
Right. And this is where we lived. And we had two rooms. My grandmother and grandfather had two rooms, and the little factory upstairs where he had... three or four young boys working for him. And I remember when I was very small, after my father left and we moved to that courtyard. We had been living somewhere else, but when my father left, my mother wanted to be close to her folks, and so we moved into that courtyard. And I remember going upstairs, and there was this big vat with the leather in a big vat with certain brine, and I wanted to look in, and I fell into it. So that was really funny. And the boys that worked there, some of them was not so nice to me anyway. I don't want to really say anything about that. It wasn't nice. I was only about 6 years old.
Well, there were lots of other, there were lots of neighbors we had. We used to have the children in this very court, and we used to play with them. We used to have games and play with them, and subsequently I became very friendly with this Hannah, like I mentioned her before, Hannah Bramchik, and she went to school with me. And when I got the measles, she continued to go to school, and at that time they gave out wooden shoes to the children, wooden sole shoes to the children in school. And since I had the measles, I didn't get the shoes. And I'll never forget how awful I felt because I didn't get the shoes. They were clopping around with the shoes, and I couldn't clop around with the shoes. So I felt very neglected and very, but they didn't have another pair of shoes to give me. So I was very unlucky when I had the measles. I was very sick when I had the measles. It's a terrible disease, and I'm glad to hear that they have now some anti-things for measles.
But I want to say is that we'd had no doctor in town.
What did you have, like?
We had what is called a felsha. He was like a pharmacist, and we had a pharmacy, and he substituted for the doctor. Well, we didn't have a doctor in town, although we, during the war, I think there was a hospital there. Wasn't there a hospital?
It must have had one.
Yeah, but we didn't have a doctor that we can call on if a child got sick. I remember my sister Esther, she got scarlet fever, and she almost died, and we hadn't. No way of doing anything.
That's
for
right,
her.
And it's amazing, really.
Yeah,
amazing that we were all living in such small quarters, such close quarters, that all of us didn't get these diseases. Shirley had the typhus, which is not typhoid fever; it's entirely different. The typhus is a much more serious disease. I didn't get it. The rest of us didn't get it. Esther had this. A scarlet fever, which it was treated for something else. She needed to be treated with heat, and the doctor, who was a German woman, came in and treated her with ice packs. And she was about 3 years old, and she almost died. And my grandfather came in to see if she was living or dead, and he put a feather under her nose to see if she was breathing. That's how sick she was, but she recovered just naturally. And I guess by the grace of God.
Did people die very often? I mean, were you aware of people dying because there was no medical, real medical attention?
I remember that Dreje's little daughter died of scarlet fever just before Esther got better.
Yeah.
That little girl died. She was also probably about 5-6 years old.
We were really not aware of death.
Not too much.
No. We were too young to even know, to think about it.
But I do remember this child dying in the same court where we lived.
Well, also, from malnutrition, the children suffered a great deal. Lillian was one of them. She had such infections on her scalp. That with big blisters of pus all over her head from malnutrition because she didn't get the proper food. All we lived on was potatoes and bread when we had it. So it was really, an orange was when you were dying, you got an orange, you know?
Well, you had to be very sick.
Yeah, you had to be very sick to deserve an orange.
Or, for that matter, chicken soup was also scarce. Everything was scarce.
So she was very ill with all those infections.
Oh, my hair fell out on that side where I had. Yeah. I remember it was this side, the right side. It was all covered with pus, and Sylvia got that later.
Yeah.
And when we were going to America, Sylvia still had a little bald spot right there, where she had it. But her hair was already growing, so the doctors did not take too much notice of it. But she got it also because we were all malnourished.
Yeah.
And here, too, in this country, when I was 13 years old, I think I weighed 78 pounds. So I was eligible to go to a camp for deprived children. And I went there because I qualified with my weight. Mm-hmm. And so I benefited that way because I loved the place. Madeline and I both went there. We had such a great time.
Why don't you tell the name of it?
The name of the place was called Felicia. Later on, after we were growing older, 14, 15, we were able to go to Camp Madison. and that was a charge. In Felicia, we paid $3 for the 2 weeks. My mother paid that. And the next time, I think we had to pay $5 for 2 weeks for each child. And then my sisters, Esther and Sylvia, went also. Through the Madison House, they arranged all these things. Uh-huh. It was a settlement house where we learned a great deal.
Let's talk about that. Let's first talk about how was it that it was decided that you and your sisters and mother would come to America?
Well, my father sent for us. He sent money. The war ended, and he sent us money. I guess there was some correspondence between mother and father, and he sent us $500 and we had applied to come to America, and that's how it was. We were, I guess it was always intended that the family would be joined together. And he certainly wasn't coming back to Poland, so we were going to America. And that's how we did it. We came to America. We decided to go to America to be with my mother, her husband, and we with our father. But it didn't work out the way we had originally planned. And I think we spoke about that in the first tape, when my father was ill in the hospital and resumed a relationship probably with a young woman whom he had relationship prior to our coming, and he had second thoughts about taking on such a big responsibility, a wife, four children. There was no apartment. He didn't get us an apartment. He was still in the hospital. And we sort of wandered around for a while among the relatives, Shirley with one cousin of my father's, although my father was the one who did not wish to start a life together. His cousins were very sympathetic, and cousin Morris Bloom took Shirley, Morris Bloom and Bertha Bloom took Shirley to live with. I went with my Uncle Joe and Aunt Becky to live with them until we could establish a place that my Uncle Joe was on my mother's side. But my mother went with my father's cousin with two children, and that was a very big. I can only say that was a big sacrifice on their part to take in three people when they themselves had three children in a two-bedroom apartment. But they were the ones who were sympathetic and believed that my father should have done it, but as long as he didn't, they took us in.
I just want to emphasize the fact that when my mother and we came to this country, into a strange land, with strangers all around us. My father was ill, and we had to be separated, and the family had to be separated. It was the most painful time in our lives. I went to live with my father's cousins, whom I never saw in my life. She went to live with an aunt and uncle whom she never saw in her life. The two younger children, of course, went with my mother, so they were a little bit more secure. But we suffered painfully to be separated from the rest of the family and have to live with strangers. It was a very terrible time. And I lived with them
About 3 months
until my mother, my uncles were able to find an apartment for us on the Lower East Side on Henry Street, 37 Henry Street, on the fifth floor, and we all a bedroom, living room, and kitchen, three rooms, and it had a toilet in the house, which was a great advantage. Just a toilet, no bath or anything, and we moved down there, and we started going to school in PS1.
We transferred to PS1 because right. Originally we were in PS40 in the Bronx, and I went from my teacher, whom I cannot forget either. Her name was Reese, Miss Reese, and she was a doll. She, I think, mentioned that on the tape. I hate to be repetitive, but
okay.
Should I repeat the story? Well, she was very sweet to me, I guess. She asked me to tell the story when I was able to speak a little bit, so I did tell that story, which I mentioned earlier. And when I had to leave, I had to be transferred out of the school from her class. She embraced me and she kissed me. I thought that was, when looking back upon it now, I have not seen a teacher do this, and nor have I ever heard anybody doing this. Teachers don't do this. She was very demonstrative. She embraced me, she kissed me, and I said, goodbye, children. That was my experience in PS 40, and I still remember that because it was pleasant. It was very pleasant. I learned to speak. I learned to read. She was very proud of me reading. I came from Poland, and I could read Polish very well. So I came here and read the same sort of alphabet. And I read here probably very wrongly, but she told me to read in front of other teachers. I didn't know what I was reading, but I was reading. I read very well. I guess I could have said Jack and Jill. Jack, I can't imagine how I could have said Jack, because the C and the K in Polish are pronounced. It's not a K altogether, but I must have been able to read other things, because she always told me to read in front of teachers. And this was when I was here only a short time. So she was a very understanding person. She was young. She was young and very beautiful. I loved her. And she must have been a very good teacher. She let me go to the other kids, other children's benches or seats. When I couldn't understand her the first day or two, I was very, very unhappy. I didn't understand one single word. And she did not mind my getting up to sit next to another Jewish child who I knew could speak some Yiddish. And I asked her, what did she say and what is going on in this classroom? So she never stopped me from going out of my seat and into this other child's seat. And I think she was a lovely teacher, and I wish there were more like her.
Well, I too had the same experience as far as understanding the language. I didn't know any English at all. And when I got into, they put me, according to my age, they put me, I think, in the fifth grade. But they might have put me in any grade, because I didn't understand. I was like deaf and dumb. I could not understand what they were saying. Then when I was transferred, finally, when we moved to the Lower East Side and we started going to PS1, I began to understand some English and be able to speak. But I had a problem, I think, over there I was okay with the arithmetic already. I had a problem with arithmetic in the earlier grades, but I finally mastered that. But I, too, had a wonderful teacher, one teacher, a Miss Adler, who wanted me to continue going to school during the day after I graduated. At that time, we used to go to the eighth grade, not like now, where you, from the sixth, you go to junior and so on. At that time, the elementary school was through the eighth grade. So when I was ready to graduate, she wanted me to go on to day high school, and she said she would try to get me a scholarship. But I go, I said, I can't. I have to start working and supporting and helping support the family. And I couldn't. I had to go to night school. But she was the one who really was very understanding also and very helpful in my school at life, in my life at school. There was another teacher who was very mean. She was horrible. But anyway, I graduated with honors, and everything was just fine.
Were you treated badly as far as being greenhorns or being immigrants in any ways?
I don't remember anything. Do you? I don't remember.
Yes, I remember that the children used to say, oh, you're a greenhorn, or I said, oh, well, you're born in Boston. At that time, I guess I spoke with a broad A, because that's how I read English, and I still speak that way. So very often they would say, well, you're born in Boston. They would ask me that question, but they did say greenhorn. I recall being not called, maybe, but I heard the word very often. I'm not sure if it was applied to me specifically, but I did hear the word, and I don't think it bothered me very much anyway.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Getting back to before you got here, the voyage itself, do you remember your feelings about being in steerage on the boat?
Well, the only thing, I didn't really care that we were in steerage. I didn't know any different. So wherever they put us was okay with us. I mean, we were never used to any luxuries. We were, you know, as I said before, very poor, and we didn't know the difference. But the only thing that I remember, I was already 13, and our cousins Rose and Sylvia were traveling with us, and they were older. And they, of course, maybe were flirting, and there were some women from Czechoslovakia who were married women coming here to meet their husbands. But they were not very nice. I remember how I was introduced to sex on the boat, on the ship. I remember waking up during the night. I might have gone to bed early. I don't know what time it was, maybe 11, 12 o'clock at night. And these women were with the stewards. We were all sleeping in a big dormitory, maybe 500 people in one room. And these women, stewards, the sailors, were sleeping with those women, and they were having sex with them. And the lights were on, and everybody was yelling and applauding while they were having sex. This was my introduction to sex. That's just how I didn't know what they were doing, but someone, I think my cousin, explained it to me. I didn't know what it was.
I remember seeing that also, but I did not know exactly what was happening. Anyhow, I was seasick throughout the